and talked to, pretty sure it was a sergeant, a colored sergeant, and I asked him, well, I told him that there was, you know, women and kids over there that were wounded. Could he help them, or could they help them? And he made something to the remark, the only way he could help them was to kill them. And I thought he was joking, or didn't take him seriously. And I took off again, and as I took off, my crew chief said that the guy was shooting into the ditch. And as I turned around, I could see a guy holding a weapon pointing towards the ditch.
When he flew back again, Hugh Thompson helped evacuate one survivor left in the ditch, a little boy. As part of the inquiry, General Pierce and a small team traveled to Vietnam. They spent a week there gathering documents and interviewing Vietnamese witnesses. The audio tapes of the Vietnamese testimony weren't released to the BBC, but the interviews conducted with the survivors in the film 4 Hours in My Lai confirmed the inquiry's evidence. Sa Thi Quy was a villager in My Lai. She watched the killings in the ditch.
The people were chased into the ditch like ducks. They fell head first. They were crying, "Oh God, have pity. Please let me up. We are innocent. Have pity." They shot all the people dead. Then silence. Tiny children crawling along the edge of the ditch. It broke your heart. I thought I was going to die. I couldn't breathe. I was injured, so I crawled back home.
If the helicopter pilot Hugh Thompson became a hero of the Pierce inquiry and of My Lai, then Colonel Orrin Henderson became the villain. Here he is telling Pierce he'd seen only 6 to 8 civilian dead.
Did you see any bodies in this area?
No, sir, I did not see any civilian dead other than the 6 to 8 that I observed to the south side of My Lai 4.
General Pierce was convinced that Henderson, the overall commander of Task Force Barker, had masterminded the cover-up of the My Lai massacre. He was inexperienced and came over as arrogant. He'd only taken charge of the force the day before the operation, and he'd never seen combat. You can also hear from several testimonies that Henderson had been informed very soon after the massacre about the dead bodies in the ditch. Hugh Thompson himself had gone to see him 2 days after My Lai to make a formal complaint, which Henderson ignored. General Pierce asked Thompson about that conversation with Henderson.
How many bodies did you tell him were in the ditch?
He said about 100, sir. Between 75 and 100. There was a bunch of people there.
How did you feel at this particular time?
Felt like there had been a massacre. I told him something else, you know. He asked me something about how did the bodies get in the ditch. And I told him I didn't know. I said, but I don't think the Americans are going to take a bunch of dead bodies and throw them in a ditch. Or they might even do that, but they're not going to put live bodies in the ditch with the dead ones. And the Vietnamese are not going to all huddle up in the ditch. And that's the part that did not make sense to me, is how all the bodies got in the ditch.
When Colonel Henderson was questioned at the inquiry about Hugh Thompson's claims, he denied them. As you can hear, they all used the term non-combatants instead of civilians.
Did Mr. Thompson mention anything to you about landing alongside of a ditch that contained a large number of bodies?
No, sir.
Did he mention to you seeing a colored sergeant point his weapon in the direction of a ditch which contained some dead non-combatants or non-combatants?
No, sir, he did not report to me any incident of a U.S. soldier firing into a ditch filled with non-combatants or with anybody.
Recalled 5 times to give evidence, Colonel Henderson continued his denials. He explained to the inquiry that after the My Lai operation was over, he'd intercepted 30 to 40 of the returning soldiers to congratulate them and to quiz them about the event.
So I told them that the reports that I had received led me to believe that they'd done a damn fine job and that I was their new brigade commander and appreciated the fine job that they had done for the brigade. Then I asked them in a group, does anybody here, any individual, any of you, observe any acts against non-combatants, any wild shooting? Did any of you, or did you have knowledge of anybody killing any civilians in this operation? And I got silence. The men had their heads high. There was nobody that was trying to ignore my eyes. I looked at it, had every individual there. They seemed to be in good spirits. They didn't appear to be a bunch of soldiers who had just gone out and shot up the countryside and had killed a bunch of women and children.
Did it ever occur to you that psychologically that this was a very poor time and very poor circumstance to be asking individuals if they committed atrocities?
I really didn't stop and think of it, but I have thought of it. I have thought of it since, and I agree. It psychologically, yes, it would have been a bad time, and I wouldn't expect a man to stand up and say, "Yes, I killed a bunch of people."
The investigation into the cover-up is at the heart of the Pierce inquiry. You can hear the exasperation in General Pierce's voice as he questions Colonel Henderson. You can picture Pierce dragging on his enormous cigars, drinking coffee after coffee, having to finish this inquiry by March 1970, before the statute of limitations ran out, 2 years from the date of the crime. The revelations were accumulating. There had been a massacre on an unprecedented scale and an equally massive cover-up. By now in the inquiry, we'd learned that both companies, Bravo and Charlie, had received the same orders from the top to kill. But then we learned that they both, suddenly, received the same orders not to kill from several officers separately. Dennis Bunning was a young conscript in Charlie Company, another of the few who refused to kill on that day. He was in a third village close by, Binte. This is what he told the inquiry.
When we were about halfway through the village was when we got word over the radio to quit killing people.
Okay, how did you hear about this?
Well, as close as I can remember, you know, I'd come to Lieutenant Brooks over the company net, and then he told us.
Do you remember what his words were?
Well, not exactly, you know. He said something to the effect of that Captain Medina says that that's enough shooting now, that we have to quit now. And to me, it didn't make any sense. You know, I couldn't figure out why we had to quit right now, you know, when Medina said we were going to go through, but all I could ever figure out was, well, we figured he got away with as much as he probably thought we were going to get away with or something like this, you know.
The revelations, however, were not over. The Pierce inquiry uncovered the fact there had also been extensive raping on that day, and mainly in the village of Binte. That's where Dennis Bunning had been posted. Most rapes were committed by his platoon of Charlie Company. Bunning bravely spoke out against his own unit.
Now, you've told us yourself, the order was passed to stop the raping.
No, to stop the killing. The raping still went on.
Oh, the raping still went on after the order.
Yeah, and when these guys first started raping a girl, you know, these just young girls, some were 15, 16 years old, you know, some down as low as 13 and maybe even 12. I'd go up to a guy, because I'm bigger than him, you know, and I'd grab him and say, "You leave that girl alone." I had about five guys come to me, and they says, "Look, Bunning," everybody goes by last name, says, "Look, Bunning, you leave us alone and we're going to kill you."
On the basis of this strong testimony from Bunning and from other sources, including Vietnamese sources, General Pierce was able to conclude that there were 18 confirmed rapes in this one hamlet alone, including gang rapes. Phan Thi Sinh witnessed the rape of her sister.
I looked out of the house and saw my sister Mui. She was 14 that year. An American was pressing on top of her. She had no clothing on her. At the time, I didn't understand what that meant. My sister was trying to resist him. Afterwards, the American got up. He put his clothes on, and then he shot her.
General Pierce uncovered irrefutable evidence of rape and murder, and evidence that all the complaints at this time, including from the Vietnamese, had been ignored. The responsibility for this, he concluded, went right to the top of the division. The man whose job it was to handle the complaints of March the 16th was Lieutenant Colonel Charles Anastransky, the AmeriCal Division Civil Affairs Officer. He chose not to pass on the complaints to his division commander, General Samuel Koster. The reason, Pierce believed, was that important promotions were at stake for both men. Here, Anastransky is talking to Pierce at the inquiry.
Do you think there was an attempt to cover this all up within the division to suppress it? Sir, I don't think the old man would do a thing like General Coster would. He wasn't that type of man.
Suppose he didn't know about it. Did you ever think about that? Did it really ever come to you to a thought, the fact that maybe, just maybe, that here's a real red-hot piece of information that the commanding general doesn't know about? I mean, is he so sacrosanct that you as a senior staff officer can't go to him?
Oh, we could go to him anytime we wish.
Yes. But did you go to him with this allegation of a war crime being committed?
No, sir, I didn't. I don't know whether it's a war crime or not.
Well, when you see somebody firing and killing any non-combatants, it's a war crime.
Sir, I didn't see anyone firing anyone.
You heard it. It was reported to you.
It wasn't reported to me.
It's
hearsay.
Hearsay or not, by the last few weeks of the inquiry, General Pierce had enough evidence to implicate Colonel Henderson, General Coster, who also testified at the inquiry, and many others. But the scale and horror of the evidence caused many of the witnesses to suddenly clam up, hire their own lawyers, and fear for their own futures. By February 1970, after nearly 2 months, the pressure on General Pierce and his team was intense. He gravely but urgently addressed the inquiry.
We're investigating a situation wherein at the present moment, we can say that we know beyond a doubt that well over 200 Vietnamese and maybe up to 500 of them were killed, and that isn't all of the story. There were numerous rapes that took place. The houses were all destroyed. 6 additional sub-hamlets were burned to the ground. All of the animals were destroyed. It's just not the people in Task Force Barker that's on trial. In the eyes of the American public, it's the Army. It's you and it's me, and it includes our country. And it includes our people in the eyes of the world.
The inquiry ended on March the 14th, 1970, nearly 2 years to the day after the My Lai massacre, on time. On that day, Pierce presented his findings and recommendations to the heads of the U.S. Army who'd commissioned the inquiry. He produced 4 volumes in total, 20,000 pages and 400 hours of audio recordings. He proposed new methods of training soldiers, guidelines for the treatment of civilians in wartime, new leadership criteria, and several prosecutions. The Pierce lawyer, Jerome Walsh, speaking to the BBC today.
We were shocked on any number of levels by the testimony. First, the killings, and then the level of incompetence up and down the chain of command. And then General Pierce was just terribly shocked by the whole thing. I think you have to remember the focus of our investigation was not the killing, but the failure to report the fact that something had happened like this, and that all the way up the chain of command, it was just hushed up.
General Pierce and his team were exhausted, but as Jerome Walsh, who'd sat side by side with Pierce for 3 months, explains, they were proud of their work.
I think the real impact of our work was on the Army itself. And by that I mean the fact that the Army did this and tried to bring these people to justice. The fact that the effort was made did survive. That it survived in the Army War College and in the Command and General Staff School, where I was told by any number of people was something that was taught to the higher-ups in the Army as their education progressed. And here, the Army War College, the same thing. It had led then to field manual writing, which spelled out the training that must be given to soldiers about war crimes. It is still part of the history and of the genes of the United States Army today. And it's been interesting to me that in the disputes over the Guantanamo base and the interrogation of prisoners there, etc., it has been the Army against the White House that has been the dispute and flashpoint, because the Army lawyers, going back to the My Lai, they know what should be done, and it doesn't include torturing prisoners.
If the report findings made an impact on the U.S. Army, in the way it trained soldiers, for one, its shocking revelations were watered down for public consumption. In his final press conference on March the 17th, 1970, General Pierce had drafted a statement for the media and used the term massacre. But the Pentagon objected to this wording. It might harm the Army's image. So Pierce used the phrase, a tragedy of major proportions.
I can say, however, and I feel that the public is entitled to know, that our inquiry clearly established that a tragedy of major proportions occurred there on that date.
General Pierce had hoped for top-down prosecutions. He had concluded that 30 senior officers had been negligent in their duty. After the inquiry, 14 officers were charged with crimes. But the only participant convicted of anything at My Lai was Lieutenant William Calley. Colonel Henderson was court-martialed, accused of covering up evidence of the massacre and making false statements. He was acquitted. General Pierce had, in effect, been gagged. He died of a heart attack in 1984, so Jerome Walsh tells us of Pierce's reaction at the time.
He was disappointed. He was behind, very much behind, and enthusiastically behind the bringing of charges against these people who had failed to report these things. I mean, the results were, of course, a fiasco for military justice in that Calley was the only one convicted. He was convicted of murder by a court-martial of his peers. Well, the message of this, for sheer political advantage, this was really disgusting because it ruined the chances of convicting the others, and it was just a fiasco.
Good evening, everyone. Less than a half hour ago, the Republic of South Vietnam unconditionally surrendered to the Viet Cong. President Dong Van...
The Vietnam War ended in 1975, but it has left far-reaching scars. The psychological trauma for the My Lai victims and perpetrators has continued.
It's why I'm old before my time. I remember it all the time. I'm all alone and life is hard. Thinking about it has made me old. I won't forgive. I hate them very much. I won't forgive as long as I live.
How can you forgive? You know, I can't forgive myself for the things. Even though I know it was something that I did and something that I was told to do, but how can I forgive that? I forgive. I can't. I live with it every day.
A Vietnamese villager from My Lai, and Bernardo Simpson, the former GI with Charlie Company, who you heard earlier in the program admitting killing at least 25 people. His role in the massacre destroyed his life. He consumed fistfuls of medication every day. He made 3 attempts at suicide and indeed succeeded in 1997. Fred Widmer, also of Charlie Company, tells us today how My Lai changed his life.
Shortly after my return back to the States, I started drinking and got into drugs. You might say for about 5 years, I went on a little bit of a bender. I was an alcoholic druggie. After a period of time, you kind of wake up and say, this is not the way things should be. I finally started to get my act together. I have psychological scars I'll carry with me to the grave. You can't erase what happened and things you did. You can't go back and rectify a past situation.
Vietnam veterans and people who came back from the My Lai experience did suffer, had many symptoms. We began to develop the concept of post-traumatic stress disorder, and it became incorporated into American psychiatric thought.
Dr. Robert Lifton is a professor of psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. Now over 80, he developed his renowned study of the relationship between historical events and individual psychology during the Vietnam War by interviewing those who took part.
My Lai was a product of what I call an atrocity-producing situation. That is, a situation, an environment, so constructed militarily and psychologically that an ordinary person, no better or worse than you or me, is capable of committing atrocities. It makes it understandable to a degree only psychologically. It does not make it forgivable, and it doesn't forgive anyone in relation to it. The people remain responsible for what they did.
Today, the killings by soldiers of Iraqi civilians in Haditha and the abuse of prisoners in Abu Ghraib remind us of the responsibility soldiers bear for their actions in wartime and their treatment of civilians. Dr. Robert Lifton has made comparisons with Iraq and Vietnam, the focus of his new research into military activity and individual behavior.
Vietnam still haunts us, and it haunts our behavior in Iraq. What happened at My Lai was extremely indicative of the American problem in Vietnam at that time and I would say the American problem in Iraq right now. Of course, the two wars are very different wars, but what they have in common is also striking. An American war of unclear purposes in a far-off place with a non-white population, which is a counterinsurgency war in which it becomes difficult or impossible to distinguish combatants from civilians, with the additional element of an occupation in Iraq and all the perils and psychological contradictions of such an occupation. And we've had a series of atrocities in Iraq, though they've been smaller ones. Nonetheless, there is this everyday struggle with the possibility of atrocity, in which, again, the men and women fighting in Iraq become both victims and executioners.
Most Americans, if they know anything about My Lai, know that some soldiers killed some civilians. But they have little grasp of the scale of the massacre. People may have heard of Lieutenant Kelly, but what about My Kay, Bin Tay, Henderson, and Anna Stransky? A simpler, sanitized My Lai massacre has become the accepted version of events. 40 years on, the lessons that were learned from the Piers inquiry have been largely forgotten. It's almost as if it never happened. But the problem with cover-ups is they set the stage for further abuses. Today, the public has difficulty believing its troops in Iraq and Afghanistan are capable of atrocities because they don't understand that they've happened before. Men like Hugh Thompson, Ron Haberle, Leonard Gonzalez, Ronald Ridenour, Dennis Bunning, and General Piers, whose stories you've heard in this program, are heroes we should be proud of, but we've marginalized them. The men at My Lai still alive today deal with the massacre in their own ways. Ron Haberle continues to photograph, but for his own pleasure. He was unable to take any war photos after that fateful day.
It is true. I really didn't take a photograph for a while, but I did start picking up again and taking out my camera and just started doing stuff for my own pleasure. Just started recording my travels. 2001, I did a bike trip from Hanoi to Saigon, and we did stop at the village of My Lai. It's not the same as it was because the area is very much built up and that. They do have a museum there. When I was really surprised when I walked into the museum, there's all these photographs. These are all my photos, almost like my own little museum there. And after looking at the photographs, I went out and started walking around the area, and they have the monument there, and they have who was killed at what point, and they also have the ditch. But on the wall, which was was amazing to me, was the name of every person engraved in the wall. I felt, I finally realized this is what happened. This tragedy did happen, and there was way too many non-combatants killed that day. These photographs that I've taken are a part of history. I hope people learn from this that this does happen in war. And the sad part about war is that the civilians are the ones that suffer.
Fred Widmer, a soldier in My Lai on March the 16th, 1968, today visits schools and colleges in the U.S., determined that it will not be forgotten.
In a way, I feel it is my duty to talk about Vietnam and the My Lai incident because today I feel that it has had a greater impact than it had way back in the beginning. The fact that I do get involved with students, talking to them, you try to bring out some good out of a bad situation, and whatever good that you can pass on to these students to help them in their later life, if you can reach one or two students, you've done something good.
Trên cơn bão tố ơi. The Me Lie Tapes was presented by Robert Hodiern. It was produced by Rosie Goldsmith, and the special researcher was Selina Dunlop.